Major funding for The Pulse is provided by a leadership gift from the Sutherland Family Charitable Fund. The Sutherlands support WHYY and its commitment to the production of programs that improve our quality of life. Additional support for The Pulse is provided by AstraZeneca and Independence Blue Cross.
The invention that promised women they could go from this...
Hi, honey.
...to this.
Come up and see me sometime.
With the turn of a dial. I'm Maiken Scott, and this is The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation.
Pulse.
There is this myth that scientific progress is achieved by some sort of a direct march to the truth.
I think sometimes I meet scientists, and when they hear what I do, they're a little afraid.
They will eject their entire digestive tract, and then they will grow a brand new one.
Weird ideas are all over the place.
So the question is, why?
What are we always so against?
What do you get for having a bigger brain?
Well, you'll probably hear the sound of a lot of Russian water dripping.
Who say zero?
On today's show, the safest place to have a heart attack. When gaining 40 pounds is the least of your problems, and what zebrafish can teach us about hearing loss. But first up, there are a lot of inventions aimed at making us more beautiful, more enticing to the people we hope to entice. Think orthodontics, alcohol, Spanx. But there's a little dial on the wall that perhaps has done more than any other item to assist us in matters of seduction. The Pulse's Todd Bookman has the backstory on one of the great American inventions.
When your mother is a knockout, this undoubtedly affects the path your life takes.
He was always very aware of aesthetics because his mother was a model in New York City.
Joel Spira was family to not only lookers, but also very successful, driven people. His dad used to frequent speakeasies before gaining a seat on the state liquor board. His father-in-law started an electronics company, then a giant magazine publishing business.
His sister ended up going into the art world and became the number two at the Guggenheim. So there's always been this right brain, left brain, the arts and the sciences in our family, very Bauhaus.
This is Joel Spira's daughter, Susan Hockarinen. Following in the family tradition, she earned a PhD in applied plasma physics from MIT and is involved with several arts organizations. Her father, son of the model, served in the Navy during World War II, where he worked on radar systems. Then Spira went and got his physics degree before moving to New York City. It was there, in his Manhattan apartment in 1959, where Spira's tinkering would result in the device that forever changed the way humans see each other. It was a new type of transistor that dramatically shrunk the hardware required to lower the lights, the dimmer switch. Before his invention, there were dimmers in use in ballrooms and on Broadway and in other engineering applications, but they were often these very big, ungainly devices that had to be hidden in back rooms, where they emitted a ton of heat. Spira's advancement, his transistor, was small enough and safe enough to slip into electrical boxes in the wall. It functions sort of like the way a dam controls the amount of water moving through. Picture a gate opening and closing rapidly, letting in little bursts of power.
You can turn on and shut off something very, very fast, right? It's almost like extreme flickering of a light. And if you turn it on and off fast enough, our eyes kind of aggregate that light and it looks like it's actually less light. And that's really all that's happening. So it's basically a super fast light switch that makes it feel like the light is at a much lower intensity.
Brent Protzman is an engineer at Lutron Electronics, the company Joel Spira formed when he began production of the dimmer switch in the 1960s. The headquarters are still in Coopersburg, just outside of Allentown, Pennsylvania. In the early days, Lutron didn't market its dimmer to electricians or contractors. Instead, they wanted to appeal to a different audience, to women, to wives interested in perhaps generating a little extra spice at home. Picture Betty Draper bored in the suburbs. The company called its dimmer the Capri. Susan Hockarinen says every detail of the ad campaign was considered, right down to the packaging.
He was looking for a box that was attractive, and he found that a company did an overrun of perfume boxes. This box manufacturer had these beautiful perfume boxes, and he said, you know what, I'll take these off your hands and just print my name on it. And these were beautiful boxes when everybody else was doing industrial boxes.
Along with the nice boxes, he set up displays in New York department stores like EJ Corvettes, so women could experience the dial for themselves. A side-by-side promotional photo showed a stay-at-home mom sipping coffee under bright lights. But when they get dimmed, out comes a domestic goddess. A half acre of décolletage on display, her face softly burning with desire.
The theme in the early days was dial romance.
Michael Pacina is the current president of Lutron. He says the Don Draper-style campaign was built around the idea that kids could still do their homework after school at the dining room table. But once they were safely tucked in, the adults could ponder making more kids at the turn of a knob.
Because there's nothing more romantic than that beautiful flicker of a candlelight, and the dimming technology could allow that to happen. So any light for any need or any use of the space. And the dining room was a nice place for that.
The dimmer soon expanded beyond the dining room and into the living room and eventually the bedroom. It gave these spaces access to the secrets of Hollywood lighting designers.
If you do the lighting well, the shadows on your face are interesting and dynamic. So it actually, as you move, you watch each other's faces and you look attractive, but it's also interesting and dynamic.
The soft light softens hard edges, the wayward hairs, the bags under our eyes. It seemingly glances off surfaces rather than spotlighting them. But does it actually kickstart our libido in a more primal way? That's the question I pose to this guy.
Name and title?
I'm Keith Richards of the Rolling Stones. I'm lead guitarist. Is that the right level of sound?
Yes, but your real name and title.
Oh, my real name. Well, I have an alter ego. I'm George Brainerd, a professor of neurology at Thomas Jefferson University.
Brainerd, who I would have pegged more a Simon and Garfunkel guy, has spent his career studying light's impact on humans. In fact, he says you should think of light like a drug, in that the quantity consumed correlates with a measurable chemical change in the body, a response. So does dim light work like a prescription drug on us, kickstarting our desires?
I think it's excellent marketing, but I'm afraid I can't cite the science behind it.
Okay, no one has proven that the dimmer is the little blue pill or pink pill on the wall, but Brainerd says that doesn't mean dim light doesn't influence our behavior.
We know for a fact, things that I can say with more clarity, is when you dim the light in the evening, you hasten the onset of the production of the hormone melatonin. That's related to calming the body down, preparing it for sleep. And of course, romance is something we often do around the time of sleep. So you're gearing down from the heavy workday, slowing the pace, and perhaps getting in the mood.
In its 50-plus years on the market, the dimmer has evolved into something far more than a romantic tool. Bill Bram is an architect at the University of Pennsylvania, where he leads a program on sustainable design.
The dimmer has found a whole bunch of new uses, but primary among them is the saving of energy.
Less light uses less electricity, plus lower light helps light bulbs last longer. Joel Spira and Lutron knew this from the beginning, and now they, along with other dimmer manufacturers, market this angle along with the aesthetic one. Bigger buildings, think airports and skyscrapers, use dimmers to cut costs. And a lot of modern offices strategically dim lights at certain times.
So the dimmed light in the office is typically, if it's being done well, is being dimmed in response to the amount of daylight available, to keep the amount of light constant, to save energy. All of which is still in the service of making you work as hard as you can as for as many hours as you can, which I would describe as the opposite of what you do when you come home or what you want to do when you come home and what the dimmed light at the table or the candle at the table helps you to achieve.
Lutron now sells thousands of other products, including electronic window shades and other energy-conscious devices. And while Joel Spira is named on hundreds of patents, it will be the dimmer switch that he's forever linked. In 2010, the original was added to the Smithsonian's collection. Michael Pacina, the current president, joined Spira at the unveiling.
I knew him almost 39 years, and I rarely heard him a loss for words. But I remember we were standing there before the case was unveiled with where the product was, I said to him, I leaned over and I said, Chief, this is a pretty big deal. And he said to me, oh, this is about everybody. This is about everybody. And as they opened and took the shroud off the case, there was one of Alexander Graham Bell's original telegraphs. There was a Thomas Edison light bulb. And there was Joel Spira's light dimmer, first notebook, and original prototype. And I looked at him, and he couldn't say a word. I just said, it is a big deal. And he just went and shook his head.
Joel Spira was still the face of the company when he passed away in April of this year at the age of 88. He's survived by his wife of six decades, Ruth, and their three daughters. The first line of his obituary in the New York Times said he was a man who, quote, changed the ambiance of homes around the world and encouraged romantic seductions of all types.
He would have been tickled pink with that, because I'll tell you, their code names for each other, which has never been told publicly, is Big Ben and Ruby Begonia. You know, they were old-time, I think, movie references, but they would sign birthday cards to each other and Valentine cards, so they were always romantic. And we'd always get, from my father, all of us daughters would get chocolates on Valentine's Day from your secret admirer.
Chocolates, love notes, nicknames. This guy was smooth. And with his invention, the rest of us could feel a little smoother, too. For The Pulse, I'm Todd Buchman.
This is The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation. I'm Maiken Scott. Prisons have a lot of medical issues to deal with. Inmates are more likely than the general public to have chronic health problems, mental illnesses, to be HIV positive or addicted to drugs. And there's another creeping concern. Female inmates tend to put on a lot of weight. Eating means comfort, it passes the time, and exercise options can be limited. Tanya English visited one Philadelphia facility that's trying to offer alternatives.
To get to the gym at Riverside Correctional Facility, you pass through a metal detector, two heavy doors, and then head down the hall. There's a basketball court, like the ones you'd see at any high school, except there's a friendly and beefy corrections officer on guard near the three-point line. 16 stationary bikes are set up in a half circle in the corner.
All right, we're going to do a couple of five-second sprints, okay? If you can. If you're still learning, take it easy.
One or two inmates are struggling, but on bike number two, Lakeisha Montgomery is pedaling fast and singing loud.
Let's go! 10, 9, 8.
Her hair
seven,
is braided back into cornrows. She has a sprinkle of freckles across her nose and high cholesterol.
I didn't think that I would be able to keep up, because I'm not the skinniest thing in the bunch, but...
But she is keeping up. Montgomery has two teenagers and a toddler back at home. Between her job and her kids, she says she never worked out. Now Montgomery spends time in the prison yard almost every day, but doesn't get any exercise there either.
Well, the outside is not a real outside. It's like a little mini garage, four walls, you know. They have a basketball court there, but I don't play basketball. It's a lot of people that come out, so you don't have room to really jog or walk around. It's just like you sit out just to get some air, you know?
She's been at Riverside for 4 months. First time, last time, she says. And meantime, spin class is something to do.
Keep away frustration, you know, being locked up. It helps you get through.
In 2011, biking advocates from the nonprofit group Gearing Up persuaded prison officials to let them bring in bikes to teach indoor cycling. Founder Kristen Gavin says before, she had mentored ex-offenders out in the community.
And over, I had conversations with women who were saying, you know, while I was incarcerated, I put on 60 pounds, I put on 70 pounds. I'm like, how long are you in prison for? 6 months.
Gearing Up is working with researchers at Temple University to track the women's weight, body image, and sense of connectedness. It's early, but they've already found improvements in at least one measure of heart health. Gavin says at first, women come to class because they want to stop gaining weight. Then they find other reasons to keep coming back.
you know, I could speak to myself. If I weren't given the opportunity to be physically active, I'd probably go a little crazy. I probably wouldn't be able to manage my emotions, my temper, my anger. I think anger management is a huge issue for a lot of women who are in the prison. They've been victims of trauma and abuse.
And of course, some of them have hurt other people. Exercise is a way to release all sorts of emotions.
We're almost there. I see you, Jean.
Erica Tibbetts from Gearing Up is leading the class. She has short red hair, and the swoop of her bangs is wet with sweat. Tibbetts is in bike shorts. Everyone else has on prison blues, long navy pants, and a white t-shirt.
The worst problem seems to be women don't have good sports bras in here.
9, 8, 7, 6.
No one has a water bottle either, and exercise gear isn't allowed. Tibbetts says women come to class anyway and work with what they have. Jean, on bike 10, for example, wrapped a long piece of scratchy brown paper towel around her head to make a sweatband. Climb up on a bike and there's a sense of freedom, even if you're not going anywhere. At the beginning of each class, one by one around the circle, the women set their intention for the ride.
I'm Jennifer. I'm leaving back my past.
I'm Alethea, and I'm leaving behind depression.
I'm Kashima, and I'm leaving back stress.
I'm Sheik, and I'm leaving behind wrongful mistakes.
On average, the women at Riverside gained about 30 pounds in just a year. The weight gain for men was closer to 2 pounds. Bruce Herdman, the prison's chief of medical operations, says weight gain is a problem, but it's not the most urgent problem.
The chlamydia rate, 6.6% on admission. We'll treat 1,000 people this year for HIV. The hepatitis C rate here, and largely because of intravenous drug use, is 13%. So then you have hypertension, diabetes, all of the regular things.
The prison is working on the women's weight issue. But first, the medical team had to challenge some conventional wisdom. Some staffers thought weight gain was a good thing.
Not clinicians, but security, that drug-addicted women and men were coming in, and they were emaciated, and they needed to gain 30 pounds or 40 pounds. And, you know, we just had to disprove that.
The big change was the food. Portion sizes are smaller now. Last year, the prison cut calories from nearly 2,900 a day to 2,500 calories, and that's for men and women. That helped, but prison meals aren't the only food that's around. A favorite do-it-yourself dinner is called Chi-Chi's.
Oh, Lord. It's where you mix ramen noodles with cheese puffs. You put them in hot water, you put the meat inside, you can do honey mustard sauce or ranch on top, and you just put it in a potato chip bag and you mix it up. It's actually pretty good.
Amanda Cortez has been in prison for 5 years and eating like that for most of that time. She says food is a way to fight boredom and depression.
Some people get like 2 or 3 trays, so they get fat like that. And then a lot of people I notice eat a lot of bread. Like people take whole loaves of bread to their room.
So Cortez spends to keep the weight off. And on visiting day, her 10-year-old noticed.
When he first seen me, he was like, Mommy, you got skinny. So I was excited. No, I don't want your number. I don't want to get...
During a year with 3 spin classes a week, Cortez dropped 90 pounds. At the end of class, before the goodbyes and the sweaty hugs, there's a last ritual. The women don't even talk about losing weight. Instead, they talk about what they've gained.
I'm Sharina, and I'm bringing sexy back.
I'm Jean, and I'm bringing back my bikini.
Okay.
I'm Ruth, and I'm bringing back faith and confidence.
I'm Erica, and I'm bringing back a real sense of, like, teamwork, you guys. Yeah. Like, it was really cool. That was such a good atmosphere. Yeah. And so much joy.
Tanya English reporting from the Riverside Correctional Facility in Philadelphia. And the medical director she interviewed mentioned that weight gain, serious as it is, pales in comparison with some of the other health issues they are dealing with there. For example, mental illness. That's something correctional facilities across the country are struggling with. And joining us now to talk more about this issue is John Snook. He is the executive director of the Treatment Advocacy Center. His organization has published several research papers on this issue. And for example, they have found that now about 1 in 5 inmates has a serious mental illness like schizophrenia. John, thank you so much for being here.
Thanks for having me.
If about 20% of inmates have a severe mental illness, what does that mean? Put that into perspective for us.
Well, what we're talking about is if you are in a prison facility, you are most likely every day to have contact with someone whose illness is so bad that they are going to be acting out. They are going to be struggling with treatment. They're really going to be in basically the worst situation you would see them in.
Are those inmates getting treatment in prison?
I think what we're finding is that jails and prisons are really trying to do their best. But if you take a step back and think about it, it's just not a situation designed to care for someone who has an illness that causes them to either act out, not be able to understand commands, or to be in a situation where there are individuals that may want to victimize or harm them. If we were thinking about it and we said, what's the worst place we could treat someone who has a severe mental illness? It'd be a jail or a prison.
And do mentally ill inmates get worse while in prison?
I think the evidence is pretty clear that that is very common, unfortunately. We're getting to a point that there are so many mentally ill individuals that we're starting to see jails and prisons take the step of sort of making themselves look more like a mental health facility or have a large segment that is a mental health facility. I think Cook County Jail is a great example of this. The new executive there, Dr. Nika Jones, is a clinical psychiatrist by trade, and she's now head of one of the largest jails in the country.
There's been a big effort by mental health advocacy groups to reduce the use of isolation for inmates with severe mental illnesses. Where does that effort stand?
I think there's been a lot of success. I think at the end of the day, this is one of those situations where jails and prisons are really trying to figure out what they can do differently. And this was an attempt at both protecting the individual and helping the prison just function normally. Having a person with a severe mental illness be in solitary is hell within a hell. It's the most likely situation to cause them to have symptom severity increasing, to be unable to really participate in any sort of reform, getting better, and at the end of the day, they're much more likely to have some of the really scary consequences that we worry about, things like attempting suicide when they're in a solitary confinement area for a significant amount of time.
What do you think needs to happen to reduce the number of mentally ill people in prisons and perhaps in turn affect mass incarceration in general?
What you need is for people who have a severe mental illness to never end up in a jail in the first place. Mental illness should be treated like any other illness, and when someone is struggling, they should receive medical care. Unfortunately, we've moved too far away from that, and too often it's a decision of, is this person dangerous or not? And obviously, that makes no sense when you're talking about an illness.
Is there any movement into the direction of treatment instead of incarceration?
So I've been really pleased at the landmark change that we've seen in probably even the last year or 2 years. I actually just came from a meeting where Senator John Cornyn's staff were talking about a very significant piece of mental health criminal justice reform. At the same time, Congressman Tim Murphy and Congresswoman Eddie Bernice Johnson, a bipartisan group in the House, have really taken steps to enact what would be landmark mental health reform legislation. And that's really focused on the other side, on saying we shouldn't have to worry about criminal justice reform because we should never have the mentally ill end up in a jail or a prison in the first place. And I'm really optimistic about just how much that bill has galvanized the Congress to really take a second look at what we're doing for those who have a severe mental illness.
John, thank you so much for talking with me.
Thank you.
John Snook is the executive director of the Treatment Advocacy Center, and his organization has done a lot of work around the issue of mentally ill prisoners. Did your mother tell you that listening to all of that incredibly loud music would ruin your hearing? And of course, you did not heed her warnings. Can you hear me now? How's your hearing? Chances are, by the time you realized she was right, it was too late. Hearing loss in humans can't be reversed in most cases. Our hearing, of course, also deteriorates naturally as we age or because of illness. Many animals can regrow the cells in their inner ears that enable hearing, and scientists are trying to figure out exactly how they do it.
What if this were possible in people? KCUR health reporter Alex Smith has more.
I did expect I would lose it. I didn't expect it to happen that soon.
Rob Jefferson was 17 when he started losing his hearing. It was due to a premature degeneration of hair cells in his inner ear. This runs in his family, but Rob, who's now 56, had a hard time believing it was happening.
No, it couldn't have been me. Everybody was mumbling. I can't have hearing loss, not this time. But I did. I just tried to blame everybody else.
By the time he was in his mid-30s, his hearing loss affected every part of his life.
It got worse and worse to the point where I just stopped answering telephones. I stopped going out because it was easier to stay home in an environment that I could control. It's kind of sad when you think back on it, but unfortunately, it's what a lot of people do.
When a baby like Amelia Baker comes into the world, she has about 32,000 hair cells in her inner ear. These allow her to hear whispers, lullabies, and her parents' baby talk. But before long, however, life begins to take a toll. Loud music and other sounds, certain antibiotics and other drugs, can gradually break down these hair cells. And given enough abuse, the cells die. Although losing hair cells means permanent hearing loss for humans, that's not the case for many animals.
So we're here right now at the zebrafish facility at the Stowers Institute for Medical Research.
Deep inside the Stowers Institute in Kansas City, a room with rows of small square aquariums houses about 30,000 nearly identical striped fish, each about an inch and a half long. Researcher Tatiana Piotrowski explains that zebrafish embryos are transparent, which makes them ideal for scientific study.
There are really very beautiful organisms under the microscope because you can see cells move and migrate, how they shape organs. You can see the blood flow, you can see the heart pumping.
Piotrowski studies how these fish regrow hair cells very similar to those humans have inside their ears. But in zebrafish, these cells are on the sides of their body, and they aren't used for hearing.
Here, it's not sound waves necessarily that activate these hair cells, but it's water motion. So if fish swim in their environment and there's a fish next to them or there's an object in the water, they can perceive that.
In a recent article in the journal Developmental Cell, Piotrowski and fellow researchers describe the cellular communication process that happens when zebrafish lose and then regrow hair cells. She explains that the surrounding support cells show an amazing ability to divide and transform.
You can imagine that some of these support cells act like adult stem cells in the sense that they are like a reserve pool of cells that when they're needed, they turn into a hair cell.
Tatiana's study is a beautiful study, a very complete study of this.
Dr. Ed Rubel of the University of Washington is a pioneer in this area of research. It began with an unexpected discovery he and his team made when they attempted to study dead hearing cells in baby chicks in the 80s.
Cells that were dead and gone weren't still gone. They seemed to be there, which surprised us greatly. In fact, it took us repeating the study three times in order to believe it.
Researchers have since found that lots of animals can regrow these hair cells, but Rubel thinks this ability was given up by mammals as a part of an evolutionary trade-off.
We haven't seen any reasonable amount of regeneration in any mammal. I believe that this was something that was lost along with the development of high-frequency hearing.
By studying how zebrafish and chicks regenerate these cells, researchers like Rubel and Piotrowski hope to map out a way humans' regenerative abilities can be triggered with the help of drugs. It's painstaking work, and there are plenty of questions and debate about how the cell systems work. It's also impossible to know at this stage how much hearing could be restored. But the research is worth it to Ed Rubel. People can regenerate skin and fingernails, and Rubel is convinced that regeneration of hearing is a human capability that simply needs to be unlocked.
This is a latent ability, and there's plenty of evidence that there's cells in the neonatal cochlea and maybe cells in the adult cochlea or vestibular organs that can be induced to regenerate or to transform into hair cells.
That's good news for people like Rob Jefferson, who regained his ability to hear with the help of cochlear implants. He says that after years of isolation and feeling out of touch, getting his hearing back turned things around for him.
I've got my life back. and that's what I needed.
For now, restoring hearing through cell generation is probably a ways off. Rubel thinks developing a drug may take anywhere from 10 to 50 years, but he has little doubt it will happen. For The Pulse, I'm Alex Smith.
Alex's story comes to us thanks to our health and science reporting partnership with KCUR in Kansas City. This is The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation. I'm Mike and Scott. If your heart stops, every minute that passes without intervention exponentially decreases your odds of surviving. Medicine has made big strides in treating and managing heart failure in the hospital, but heart attacks often happen on the street, at home, or at the coffee shop. And the only one who can keep you alive during those crucial first few minutes is a bystander, a stranger, a neighbor, anyone willing to perform CPR. Newly minted doctor and Pulse contributor Avir Mitra explores why CPR, despite its life-saving qualities, can be a tough sell.
Okay, hi Avir. I'm trying to talk the way I'm supposed to normally talk.
This is Amanda Pitt, a fourth grade school teacher in Philadelphia.
So I was about halfway through a run, and there's a big space next to me, and a car pulled into it, and I could immediately see that there was something wrong with the person in the passenger seat. I didn't know whether she was having a seizure or something really strange was happening with her, and then she looked like she went unconscious.
And this is what our story is about today. What happens when someone may be in serious trouble, when someone may be in cardiac arrest?
That was what I said, was like, do you need help? And they said, yes. Like,
they meaning the driver, who was a young man.
They opened the car door and pulled the person out onto the ground, who was kind of stiff and unconscious, and her lips were turning blue.
This is clearly a moment of truth, right? I mean, what would you do if you were in her shoes right now? The sad truth is, if you're like the vast majority of us, you would do nothing. You wouldn't save this person's life.
And unfortunately, they say about over 1,000 people die a day due to sudden cardiac arrest in the United States. And they have a poor chance of surviving because people aren't doing CPR.
This is John Urbiri, the program director for EMS education at the Department of Emergency Medicine at Drexel University College of Medicine. And he believes there are three main reasons why people hesitate to do CPR.
The big things are really fear of failure, not really being sure of what to do.
The second is fear of infection.
And then lastly is fear of litigation.
Think about all the advances we've made in cardiac care. Bypasses, stents, transplants, statin drugs, aspirin. We've cut the amount of cardiac deaths by a lot. But the weak link, it turns out, is us. You, me, or any bystander who could utilize CPR to keep someone alive till an ambulance arrives.
And unfortunately, it's tracked very well here in the U.S. that if you were to have a cardiac arrest outside of the hospital, that you have a very bleak chance of surviving, anywhere as low as 8%.
Statistically, the national average for surviving a cardiac arrest is only 8%. Look at that another way. If your heart stops, you have a 92% chance of dying right then and there, never making it to any modern medicine at all. Those are dismal numbers in our era, and according to a lot of experts in the field, they could be a lot better. We know this because there are certain special places in the country where you have a much better chance of surviving a cardiac arrest. You're probably thinking I'm talking about a hospital, right? Or maybe the White House? Nope.
So there was a study in casinos that found that if you have a cardiac arrest at a casino, you have a 75% chance of actually surviving that cardiac arrest.
That's versus 8% on the street. Even hospitals don't do that well.
The reason is they have cameras everywhere, so they see when someone collapses, and then all the security guards and dealers are trained in CPR and how to use a defibrillator.
Okay, so mental note. If you think your heart's going to stop, get on a slot machine ASAP. But how do we make the outside world more like a casino?
There are other areas of the country that are higher than the national average. So Seattle, King County, Washington. They save 62% of people who have an out-of-hospital witnessed cardiac arrest, which is outstanding.
Versus 8% nationally.
Correct.
How does that work? What are they doing that we need to do?
In the state of Washington, to graduate high school, you have to have CPR training, so it's a law.
So Washington State addressed the first concern, fear of failure, by exposing every high school graduate to CPR at least once. And John's second concern, the fear of infection, well, that's being countered by a new type of CPR that's showing great results and may soon become the norm. It's called hands-only CPR.
They removed mouth-to-mouth for patients, so you don't have to worry about getting any body fluid on you if you're just doing hands-only CPR.
All the icky mouth-to-mouth is gone, plus no remembering ratios of compressions to breaths. With hands-only CPR, you just do chest compressions because it turns out that compressing the chest also squeezes the lungs and moves some air. And people can survive for a while with the oxygen they already have, as long as their heart or your hands are pumping the blood around.
Survival rates are higher among those who receive chest compressions versus chest compressions and rescue breathing.
And as for the fear of litigation...
Good Samaritan laws. We need to get the word out that you are covered and you won't be sued if you are to help in an emergency situation.
Okay, so we've got three good ideas that could save lives immediately. CPR training for all students, which, by the way, became law in New Jersey and Delaware this academic year. We've got hands-only CPR, where all you have to do is press hard and fast in the center of the chest until help arrives. And we have Good Samaritan laws that are already in effect. But along the way, I started hearing about a fourth solution, an app called PulsePoint, created by a retired California fire chief.
Yes, my name is Richard Price, and I'm the president of the PulsePoint Foundation.
Richard's creation was born from tragedy.
I was out to lunch one day and heard a siren and saw the crew coming in, and then to my surprise, they pulled up right in front of the restaurant where I was eating. And right next door, somebody had had a cardiac arrest, and they were just feet from me, literally probably 20 or 30 feet away from me, but I was unaware of it. So even as the fire chief trained in CPR, I wasn't aware of, you know, that great need so nearby.
You could have the world's best CPR instructor next door to a cardiac arrest, but they might never know.
So after experiencing that, you know, and thinking about how the firefighters knew about that cardiac arrest when I didn't, it was because they were dispatched to it. So I didn't have a radio at the time, but I always had my cell phone with me.
And so the idea struck him. A GPS-enabled app could be the perfect tool to alert CPR-trained citizens of a nearby cardiac arrest.
We didn't know if it was possible to actually accomplish it.
But with the help of interns from Northern Kentucky University, paid in Doritos, Pepsis, and housing, as he puts it, he built PulsePoint. The app interfaces with the local 911 dispatcher via software installed on the dispatcher's computer. So now, when the 911 dispatcher alerts the ambulance of a cardiac arrest, that same message gets pushed to PulsePoint users nearby.
You know, you're here, the patient's here, and here are the AEDs around you.
AEDs, by the way, are defibrillators, publicly located pads that can deliver a shock to the heart to reboot it. CPR keeps the patient alive till help arrives, but a properly used AED can actually fix the problem right there in the field. Anyway, the point is the app attempts to bring the solution to the problem. Okay, so you might be wondering, whatever happened with Amanda Pitt, whose jog was interrupted by an unresponsive woman in the passenger seat of a nearby car?
Well, I helped the guy pull the woman onto the curb so we could look at her. So we laid her out on the pavement, and her lips were blue. She clearly wasn't breathing. And so I started doing mouth-to-mouth resuscitation. And then someone who was directly across the street saw what was going on and ran over to help and started doing compressions.
To clarify, the new hands-only CPR wouldn't have required those rescue breaths, but in this case, it certainly didn't hurt. Also, we don't know for sure whether this person's heart actually stopped, but that's the point. If you see someone down, unresponsive, it's better to start CPR anyway. If you were wrong and this person was alive, the absolute worst you've done is maybe broken a rib or two.
It's hard to tell time in these kind of situations, so I'm not sure exactly how long this was going on. But then she started to kind of gasp. So we stopped and just sort of watched her, and then she started to breathe normally and wake up.
Amanda's quick thinking created a situation that only happens 8% of the time. Hooray for CPR.
And then pretty much as soon as the driver saw that she was alive again, it was clear that he wanted to get her in the car and get away, because I'm pretty sure that this person had had a drug overdose, and so he wanted to get out of the scene of the crime.
Well, maybe that's not the Hollywood ending I was looking for, but I'll take it. John, for his part, travels every year to the Pennsylvania state capitol in Harrisburg, lobbying his local politicians to include CPR training in all Pennsylvania high schools. He says every politician, regardless of party, completely supports the idea and that they'll, you know, be in touch.
So you go, you talk to a guy and he's like, yeah, let me look into this. And then you go next year. What does he say next year?
It's kind of, you know, it's unfortunately the same thing, you know. It's tough.
So John and his Drexel University EMS colleagues have taken it to the streets, literally, with a program they call Sidewalk CPR.
So we'll set up like a little station or a table with CPR mannequins. Like, hey, if you want to learn how to save someone's life, you got a minute?
Learn how to save a life in a minute? Well, it turns out I do, in fact, have time for that. And I'm signing you up for the lesson, too. So here it is, the one-minute tutorial on how to save a life. You ready?
Okay. So basically what we're going to do is just quick two steps, right? So if you see somebody who's laying on the ground and they're not moving, you need to call 911. That's your first step. So call from your cell phone, or you can send someone else to call 911 to say there's a man down. And then you're going to come over and you're actually going to lift up their shirt, and then you're going to see if they're breathing. Right. And if they're not breathing, you're going to put your hands right in the middle of their chest and just start pushing hard and fast.
How fast? The ideal speed is ironically the exact tempo of Staying Alive by the Bee Gees. So consider that your CPR theme song.
So you just keep doing that until help arrives. And then you possibly could save this person's life. It's simple as that.
Simple as that.
Welcome to the future of CPR. Clean, simple, easy, and hella retro. For The Pulse, I'm Avir Mitra.
Pulse contributor Avir Mitra is a doctor who just started his residency and is specializing in emergency medicine. You're listening to The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. How many people showed up for a political demonstration or for a parade? Was it 500? Was it 5,000? It's really tough to know. Hundreds of thousands of people may show up to watch the Pope give Mass during his U.S. visit at the end of this month. But will we ever know how many people really came? Carolyn Beeler looked into the history and science of crowd counting.
I bring to you the Honorable Minister Louis Farrakhan. Let us receive him.
You can't talk about crowd counting controversies without talking about the Million Man March. It was on the National Mall in the fall of 1995.
Probably one of the best that ever was held in Washington, held by black men.
The National Park Service estimated 400,000 marchers were there. The Nation of Islam thought it was as many as 2 million, and they threatened to sue over what they saw as a lowball count fueled by racism. Boston University researchers eventually placed the crowd at 837,000, with a 20% margin of error, and the National Park Service eventually stopped making official estimates. The importance and extreme subjectivity of counting people gathered for an event is something the grandfather of modern crowd counting understood well.
Herbert Jacobs was an old-time newspaper man from Wisconsin.
This is Robert Sanders from the news office at the University of California, Berkeley.
And in the 1960s, he came to Berkeley as a lecturer in journalism. And he got interested in the estimation of crowds because at the time there were demonstrations nearly every day. And the papers like the San Francisco Chronicle and the Student Paper were publishing crowd estimates that he thought might be overinflated.
So Jacobs looked for a technique to improve these estimates. He noticed that Sproul Plaza, where all these demonstrations were taking place, was neatly divided by lines in the stone paving.
It had a grid pattern, and he thought, well, if I could get an estimate of how many people in one of these squares and multiply by the number of squares, I might be able to get a good estimate of the crowd size.
So Jacobs got the exact dimensions of those squares from Plaza Blueprints. Then he counted how many people fit in them to arrive at an average square foot per person figure for denser and then also looser crowds.
And then he would calculate the size of the space they were gathered in, divide by the square foot per person, and come up with a good crowd estimate.
The fundamental crowd counting method has remained the same ever since Jacob's time. Area times density equals attendance. But as technology has gotten better, a desire for more precise measurements has grown. Kurt Westergaard is one of those on the quest for precision. He got into the game of crowd counting in a rather unexpected way.
Somebody called us from Ireland and was trying to set a world record of clog dancing in Galloway.
Westergaard's DC area company, Digital Design and Imaging Service, didn't end up counting those cloggers. But the request did spark his interest in the science of crowd size. He quickly went on to estimate attendance at high-profile events, including dueling Glenn Beck and Stephen Colbert rallies in 2010 for CBS News. Westergaard's team starts any new job by surveying the event location to make a computer model of it. He sees his work not as laying a grid over a flat surface, like Jacobs did, but putting a fishnet on top of a 3D model, digitally, of course.
So, for example, around the Washington Monument, it's a pretty steep hill going up to the top of the monument. So one square might actually be embracing a downhill part where there's going to be more people.
Westergaard's team also scouts areas where people tend to pack together, in the shade, near stages, and on low walls or other natural seating. On a computer in his office, Westergaard pulls up an aerial image of the Benjamin Franklin Parkway in Philadelphia, where Pope Francis will give a mass during his U.S. visit. Westergaard points to some baseball diamonds that aren't far from where the Pope will speak.
We sense that that is probably going to be the highest densities when you have an open park that gives you both a live view of the stage and at the same time a view of a jumbotron or two.
Once this kind of ground reconnaissance is done, it's time to bring out the cameras. Well, exactly Westergaard and his lead photographer, Ryan Schuler, demonstrated their setup outside their office, climbing into a mobile trailer that holds a small white hot air balloon with a camera array attached.
All right. We usually pull up and start to release the balloon by opening the roof doors.
He lets the balloon out of the top of the trailer and then clips the three camera array onto the bottom. He tests out the cameras, then lifts the balloon through the roof and into the sky. Unlike on a helicopter, Westergaard and Schuler can start taking pictures low, at 10 and 20 feet above ground, so they can capture the people gathered under trees or other cover. Then they lift the balloon higher,
shooting,
taking 360-degree photos hundreds of feet above the crowd. When shooting is done, Schuler pinpoints the moment when the crowd is the biggest and overlays their fishnet grid on that image. Then he calculates how many squares are packed to different densities.
Mob density is roughly front to back and shoulder to shoulder.
Medium density is about a person per square yard. And low density means
one person per 25 square feet. That's a 5x5 square.
Schuler then counts the number of squares in the photo with each of these densities and uses that to estimate attendance. Now, there is one major downside to using this newer, snazzier technology. You have to get permission to fly things over large events. And for the Pope's visit,
the FAA has very clearly said absolutely nothing will be in the air.
So instead of estimating the crowd on the day of the event, Westergaard will be watching it on TV like the rest of us. For The Pulse, I'm Carolyn Beeler.
That's our show for this week. The Pulse is a production of WHYY in Philadelphia. Today, we want to say hello to the listeners of KCUR in Kansas City. We already got some great stories in the works with the reporters at that station, so keep tuning in. Our health and science reporters are Tanya English, Carolyn Beeler, Alana Gordon, and Todd Bookman. Charlie Kyer is our engineer, Paige Flager, our associate producer, Joel Patterson is the managing editor, and Megan Pinto, our executive producer. If you missed some of this show or any of our previous shows, subscribe to our podcast. It's on iTunes and at our website, whyy.org/thepulse. I'm Mike and Scott. Thank you for listening.
go straight to hell, boy. Go straight to hell, boy.
Supporting WHYY's The Pulse, AstraZeneca strives to create a culture where employees are excited by their work, have a clear sense of purpose, and display confidence in their ability to meet challenges and seize opportunities. More at AstraZeneca.com/careers.
Independence Blue Cross supports WHYY's The Pulse and strives to lead the way with a focus on preventing illness rather than reacting to it. They are proud to offer health programs including fitness reimbursements and health coaches. IBX.com. Independence Blue Cross. Live fearless. Ben Franklin Technology Partners of Southeastern Pennsylvania supports WHYY's The Pulse and are partners with a purpose, providing capital, counsel, and connections to technology entrepreneurs and investors in the greater Philadelphia area. More about Ben at partnerswithapurpose.org.